Look, it's hard being the pop culture friend. You're the one who knows exactly what new show is the most watched show on Netflix right now, or you're on top of the film festival calendar. Whether you are that friend or you desperately need a friend like that, allow Commotion to enter your group chat. It's a podcast hosted by me, Alamine Abdul-Mahmoud, where I talk to people about the arts and entertainment stories that you need to know, and we share all the recommendations of what you should be reading or watching or listening to. Find Commotion wherever you get your podcasts.
Washington does a 180 on Russia and Ukraine, and so go hopes at the Kremlin that Ukraine would be sidelined.
These hopes have been dashed.
I'm Marco Werman. Today, Moscow under pressure from the U.S. Plus, Cuba sends a lot of doctors abroad, but there's controversy over how they're paid.
Professionals working abroad profit the Cuban government with 85 to 95% of their salaries.
Also, an update on that plane crash in India last month. Fuel switches and a recording from the cockpit are raising questions.
They actually talked about the fuel issue before the crash.
And in the Netherlands, Gen Z can find anything on the internet, even religion.
They don't have to go to church. They can find everything on social media. So they discover like a new way of being a church.
Coming up today, here on The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for coming along this Tuesday. Caroline Beeler is away. We start today looking at Russia and Ukraine, specifically the changing tone from Washington. President Trump is putting a new kind of pressure on Russia. This week, Trump gave Moscow 50 days to sign onto a peace deal with Kyiv or get slapped with severe sanctions. Washington also announced it will increase weapon supplies to European allies with the understanding that NATO will then send those weapons to Ukraine. The Kremlin's response? Seemingly just a shrug. Top Russian security official Dmitry Medvedev has dismissed Trump's ultimatum as theatrical. Russia's foreign minister Sergei Lavrov was equally unimpressed. 50 days. Before that, there were also the deadlines of 24 hours and of 100 days. We've been through all of that, Lavrov said today. Earlier today, I spoke with Yaroslav Trofimov. He's a Ukrainian-born journalist and chief foreign affairs correspondent at the Wall Street Journal. I asked him if the Kremlin was really unfazed by the ultimatum.
It's clear that the hopes that they had about a rapprochement with Trump, some kind of new deal that would sideline Ukraine and allow for a Russian-American cooperation, these hopes have been dashed. And so now they're just trying to gauge how serious is President Trump, to what extent he will actually try to impose a punishment on Russia, and to what extent he will actually commit a serious military aid to Ukraine, allow Ukraine to remain in the fight. I think for now, the calculation in Moscow is that the U.S. is not all that serious, and that at the end of the day, the growing ability of the Russian military industries and the Russian advantage in manpower will allow Russia one day to win this war that has already gone on for 3.5 years.
So I see that Russia's stock market actually rallied after President Trump's threat to impose very severe tariffs on Russia. So I guess the financial sector is kind of following the lead from the Kremlin.
Well, you know, the Russian market is not that big and not that liquid. I mean, there is not much to sanction on Russia itself. You know, trade with Russia was minimal even before the full-scale invasion. And most transactions with Russia are prohibited as it is. So what Russia really fears is the secondary sanctions. That means the sanctions on countries such as India and China that are buying Russian oil. And if the U.S. were to deploy the full arsenal of its financial and political might to actually prevent a country like India from buying Russian oil, that would have very serious repercussions for Russia, because that's the main source of revenue for the Russian state, for the Russian army. That's how Russia is paying for its weapons production. And that's how Russia is able to recruit all this, you know, tens of thousands of soldiers every month through the promise of payments that exceed average salaries by a large factor. And that, in fact, in case of death, exceed the lifetime earnings of an average military age Russian male. And so the oil prices are already lower than they used to be. And so that's where it could really hurt for Putin. But of course, you know, that leverage is very difficult for the U.S. because India is an important partner, especially as the U.S. is trying to contain China. And so there are lots of pros and cons that would have to be weighed if such a decision were to be made.
There's also this weapons deal. The U.S. has now agreed to send weapons to European allies of Ukraine. There's some ambiguity, though, about what weapons Ukraine will actually get. What kind of weapons would most likely get Russia's attention if Kyiv were to get them?
What Kyiv really wants is long-range weapons that will allow it to strike deep inside Russia, cities like Moscow, St. Petersburg. And it's interesting that in the conversation with President Zelensky and President Trump did ask whether Ukraine is able to hit that far. The White House is now saying that this was just an expression of curiosity rather than suggestion. But in any case, viewed from Kyiv, the only way to stop the onslaught of missiles and drones that come from Russia every day is not to go after the arrows, but to go after the archer. That is, you know, there's no air defenses available in the world to protect Ukraine just with passive air defense. And in the U.S. only manufactures about 500 Patriot interceptors a year. And, you know, one or two of these, or three sometimes, are needed to intercept one Russian ballistic missile. And Russia fires several of these missiles every day at Ukraine. And so what the Ukrainians have been trying to do with the drones is to go after the entire supply chain of the Russian military industries and the factories that made everything from fuel to paint to guidance systems to warheads for the missiles and the drones. And obviously, if it were to receive long-range missiles from the U.S., it would disarm this, or at least seriously damage the capacity of this Russian military industry, and in that way protect itself much better.
Looking inside Russia, which is not an easy thing to do, do you see or hear any signs of discontent among regular Russians when it comes to this ongoing war in Ukraine? Is there any suggestion that, like, a silent opposition is growing to this war?
Well, you know, it's very hard to understand what's going on in Russia because, obviously, opposing the war is a criminal offense. People go to prison for years for, you know, the quote-unquote discreditation of the armed forces. And there is severe censorship in Russia. You know, it's a country, however, that is brittle. And we have seen it 2 years ago with this uprising by Yevgeny Prigozhin, you know, the leader of the Wagner paramilitary group. And suddenly his men, you know, found widespread support in the city of Rostov that they had seized. But right now, despite the mounting toll, the horrendous casualties, there are no protests. The population seems to be accepting it as it is. But there is no telling what will happen tomorrow, because by the very nature of these regimes that are closed and don't have a feedback loop, it's unpredictable.
Yaroslav Trofimov from The Wall Street Journal. His latest book is No Country for Love. People in Oman get ready to pay income taxes, at least some people. If your income is more than $109,000 annually, the government in Oman is going to hit you with a 5% income tax. If this sounds like a novel idea for Oman, it is. In fact, it is the first of the Gulf states to create an income tax. There's an interesting reason behind the change. Monica Malik is the chief economist at the Abu Dhabi Commercial Bank in the neighboring United Arab Emirates.
What we've really seen since 2014 is the focus on diversifying economies, but also strengthening the fiscal position of the GCC countries.
GCC, that's the Gulf Cooperation Council. When you say the economy is going through diversification, diversifying out of what?
Out of the hydrocarbons. So really since the 1970s onwards, you've seen these economies, the backbone of these economies being oil, but increasingly gas as well. And that's the same for Oman. And this is with reference to the government revenue. The majority of this comes from hydrocarbons. So you can see that the fiscal spending, fiscal deficits or surpluses are very, very cyclical based on oil prices and gas prices.
How reliant on fossil fuel revenues is Oman's economy right now?
Still very much. So depending where oil prices are, around 70 to 80% of government revenue in Oman comes from fossil fuels. And this is a trend across the region as well. The way it works here is it's largely national energy companies, oil and gas companies. The revenue goes from them to the government, and that is recycled. So it's very much, until the last 10 years, 20 years, a distributive model rather than a productive model. But as the economies look to diversify, as you know, GCC economies look to go into different areas, everything from aviation, transportation, now there's a big focus on AI, technology, areas like that. As you have a broadening economic base and a productive economic base, that will be also supportive for widening the tax base for these economies.
This tax goes into effect in 3 years. I'm wondering how much cash will this new income tax actually generate for Oman? What's the expectation?
Very limited. It's expected to raise less than 0.5% of GDP. It's going to be a very narrow base. As you mentioned, it will be for people earning over $109,000 equivalent. I think at this point, it's very symbolic, but it is a start of something that was previously seen as, for want of a better word, taboo. And that's why it's significant.
Yeah, I was wondering, I mean, are other countries looking at Oman and thinking maybe it's time we impose an income tax too?
I think they will look. They will look to see how it goes and the impact on the economy. I think at this point, there's no economy that has indicated that they're looking to introduce personal income tax. But I think Oman is the first mover. And once it's introduced, might not be in the near term, and it might be by a small amount, but this then becomes a part of the GCC economic playbook.
Monica, as you know, death and taxes are the two constants in life, we are told. So why is Oman the first in the region to create an income tax? Why is income tax not typical among the Gulf states?
Well, we talk a lot in the region about something called the social contract. And again, it goes back to the fact that most of the oil revenue does accrue to the governments through their oil companies. This is then distributed. So the well-being, the welfare of the population is through the spending of this oil revenue. But there's a couple of challenges. Number one, now at a point of energy transition, you're seeing a lot of renewable investments going on, whether it's parts of Asia, China, India, or Europe. You're starting to see the outlook for oil demand, you know, structurally long term, that is shifting. Also, we've seen very strong population growth. So these countries really do have to start adapting, looking at diversification, as the revenues do not, will not, and are not currently providing the same level of support to the population as perhaps they did in the 80s or the 1990s.
That's Monica Malik, the chief economist at the Abu Dhabi Commercial Bank in the United Arab Emirates, explaining why Oman is creating a new income tax for the first time. From one monarchy to another, it's time to count the swans. In England, swan counting is a royal affair because King Charles is officially Seigneur of the Swans, meaning he's in charge of England's swans. The crown conducts a census of the swans on the River Thames every summer. It's a tradition known as swan upping.
It's called swan upping because we go up the river and we up the swans out of the water.
That's David Barber, whose title is Marker of the Swans, an office that dates back to the 12th century.
So we travel 79 miles in 6 traditional rowing skiffs, and each family of swans we come across, we will circle our wooden boats around them. We will work them in closer and closer together until we can actually lift them out of the water by hand.
Getting them out of the water is just the beginning. Barber's team goes on to measure and weigh the swans, as well as checking them for injuries.
That is one of the most important things we do, because we have a lot of injuries from fishing tackle.
For the swan markers of yore, the annual census was mostly ceremonial. That has changed. Now it's about conservation and making sure the swans of England are healthy.
We're finding more pollution issues than we've ever found before. We have oil problems, and swans get coated in this, and then they all have to be washed off.
Avian flu has also been a problem for the swan population. Only 86 swans were found on the Thames during last year's upping, a 45% decrease from the previous year. This most recent census began yesterday and will last throughout the week. By Friday, all the swans should be counted. Coming up, the latest from the investigation into the recent Air India crash that killed 260 people. That's here on The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. In India, officials are telling airlines to inspect all their Boeing planes. That's after a preliminary investigation identified a potential cause behind a Boeing 787 Dreamliner crash last month that killed 260 people. Air India Flight 171 plummeted into a medical school less than a minute after takeoff, right in a busy residential area, a devastating incident. Investigators now think it was an issue with the fuel supply to the plane's engines that caused the crash. The World's transportation correspondent Jeremy Siegel has been following the story. So, Jeremy, what exactly was learned in this preliminary investigation?
So this investigation was conducted by the Aircraft Accident Investigation Bureau at India's Ministry of Civil Aviation with help from Boeing, GE, and experts from the U.S. and the U.K. So here's what it says. Just after takeoff, like literally seconds after takeoff, both of the fuel control switches on this plane abruptly moved to the cutoff position, and that, as you might expect, cut off the fuel supply to the plane's engines, which explains, if you remember the video of the flight, why it wasn't able to gain any altitude, and it ultimately plunged into buildings less than a mile away from the runway. Now, this is just the first piece of the puzzle. The report doesn't offer a true answer to what happened, and it'll likely take years before there's anything definitive. But it does do two things. One, it points toward the these fuel switches being turned off as the probable cause of the crash. And two, it appears to rule out mechanical failure or any sort of design flaw within the plane as a factor.
So it's a little confusing. If it wasn't a problem with the plane, if those fuel switches were actually turned off, how'd that happen?
We still don't know. And because of that, this report in a lot of ways raises more questions than it answers. Now, an interesting piece of this, Marco, what's included in the investigation is some details on the cockpit voice recordings from the final seconds of this flight. According to the report, the two pilots, one of them the captain, who had more than 15,000 hours of flying experience, and the other, the first officer, had more than 3,000. They actually talked about the fuel issue before the crash. One of them, when the plane was in the air, the report says, is heard asking the other why he cut off the fuel. And then the other responds that he did not do that. So those are the facts laid out here, but there's been a lot of speculation to fill in the gaps. One pilot I spoke to, who asked to remain anonymous, told me that the switches on a plane like this would be virtually impossible to move accidentally. They're specifically designed to prevent accidents. They're extremely difficult to turn on or off. They're locked in place. You essentially have to pull them up before pulling them down to cut off the fuel. Now, John Nance, an aviation expert and pilot who spoke with ABC, said that he thinks, based off of these findings, it has to be that one of the pilots turned them down.
It just takes positive effort. It takes either a human hand or a simian hand, and there were only two humans in that cockpit. There's enough in this report to really tell us what we've got as the remaining question, and that is why.
Now, I want to stress, Marco, again, that this is just speculation, but this is the question experts are asking. How and why did someone turn off the fuel supply?
So planes, Boeings in particular, are still taking off. What kind of response, if any, are we seeing to this investigation?
Well, as you mentioned earlier, India's air regulator has ordered all airlines to examine the fuel control switches on several Boeing models. And that's a step that some other countries, including South Korea, are taking as well. Now, this might be because the preliminary report references a notice sent out by the FAA in the U.S. in 2018 that recommended but did not mandate inspections of the locking feature on these fuel switches to make sure they couldn't be accidentally turned off. The report says Air India did not conduct inspections all those years ago because it wasn't a mandate. Now, according to Reuters, Boeing itself, along with the FAA, both issued a private notice in response to the report saying that the fuel switch locks on Boeing planes are safe. I reached out to Boeing for comment. They didn't get back to me. The FAA, for its part, confirmed with me that it did release what's called a continued airworthiness notification to the international community, letting airlines around the world know that they still believe Boeing 787s are still safe and no action is needed.
Yeah, and as to the question that I imagine a lot of potential passengers who are listening are probably asking, should we feel safe on airplanes? What's your take?
I think there are two facets to this question. One involves the specific issues surrounding this flight, and I don't want to jump to any conclusions before a final investigation is released, but I think it's certainly scary for passengers, the prospect that two single switches could somehow be turned off accidentally, purposefully, or because of some other issue, and cause an airplane to crash immediately after it leaves the ground. The second piece, Marco, I think is the big picture of air safety. You know, industry experts are always quick to point out, statistically, incidents like this are an anomaly, and air travel is still incredibly safe, especially compared to, say, getting in a car. And that's true, but with this cascade of recent incidents and the prevalence of videos of them circulating on social media, you can't ignore the visceral reaction we have as human beings. You know, when you get on a plane, there's an assumption that the plane works, the pilots are in charge of your safety, they're going to do everything they can to get you where you need to go with no incidents. Because there are now all of these questions circulating about not just the mechanical safety of planes, but also the role that pilots play, it's hard not to think twice before you board. So that's why in the months and maybe years ahead, I will be really curious to see the results of the full investigation, whether we get to see more of the cockpit recording from this flight, because it's very much still a mystery what exactly happened in those 32 seconds that this plane was in the air.
The World's Transportation Correspondent, Jeremy Siegel, thank you very much.
Thank you, Marco.
Today at the archaeological site where the ancient city of Pompeii used to be, a gift arrived, a mosaic panel on stone. The Roman artwork depicts a half-naked couple taking a bath. The mosaic had once been on display near the site, but it was stolen during World War II by a Nazi captain. Gabriel Zuchtriegel runs the archaeological site. He says this is a gesture of goodwill from a family that wanted to see the stones returned to Italy. He continued to explain that the mosaic's last owner died and his heirs are the ones who returned it. That previous owner had received it as a gift from a German captain who was in Italy during the war. The mosaic is around 2,000 years old and is considered a work of extraordinary cultural interest, according to experts. Zuchtriegel says the exact origin, however, is unknown.
Sappiamo che si riunivano in cubicolo.
While we don't know where this comes from, he says, the style of panel typically could have been displayed in rooms used for sleeping, meetings, business, and love affairs. This one depicts exactly that kind of scene. Today, it went on display at the archaeological park. Still to come on the world, Gen X sang about losing their religion. Gen Z may be finding it online. That story just ahead. You're with the world. This is the world. I'm Marco Werman. The Netherlands is one of the most secular countries in the world. About 6 out of 10 people there identify as having no religion. Church attendance among Christian denominations in particular has been slipping for a while. But as we hear from the world's Joshua Coe, young Dutch Christians are connecting with a higher power online outside of traditional ideas of what a church community is supposed to look like.
Church bells ring in the Netherlands as they have for centuries, but chances are, far fewer people are in the pews compared to past decades. The country has long had strong Protestant and Catholic communities living side by side, but within their own tight-knit social bubbles, each with its own political institutions, newspapers, schools, and of course, churches. Those bubbles popped in the 1960s as people started to see church as less and less important to their identity.
The decline became huge of church attendance, and it was not connected to your social bubble anymore, so it was even less relevant.
Ronella Sonnenberg is an associate professor at the Protestant Theological University in Utrecht. In the 1960s, almost 70% of Dutch people considered themselves religious. Today, a similar majority considers themselves non-religious. But there's one positive statistic that's caught the eye of researchers like Sonnenberg. There's a small but noticeable increase in the number of young people identifying with Christianity.
which is surprising in a way. And now we try to understand this trend. In absolute numbers, it's still not the big change, but the trend is not longer declining.
Sonnenberg says that other countries like the United Kingdom and Finland are also seeing a bump in faith among young people. And now researchers are asking why.
Young people have a lot of stress. They have a lot of possibilities, but also a lot of uncertainties, and that is growing. Does that make that the traditional faith with long history, with proven rituals, are attractive for them? Question mark.
The answer, if you ask 20-year-old Sophie Vanderberg, is yes. Faith offers her community and comfort. She says her relationship to God is like a warm hug.
You feel just fine knowing that he's with you, even though you feel alone or you feel unwanted. You know that he's there with you, and that's just great.
Vanderberg was attending Opwekking. It's a 4-day annual Christian festival.
Meer gaat worden in Jezus' naam. Come on.
Organizers say 60,000 people show up, and more than 300,000 watch online. It features traditional prayer services, but also the kind of performers that might appeal to any Dutch kid, like DJ Roberto Rosso, a Christian DJ and missionary. He plays electronic dance music with a biblical twist. The event has been going on for over 5 decades and attracts people of all ages. But this year, about half of the crowd were under 30 years old. And Rosso says young people are approaching their faith differently than their parents.
This young generation is like open-minded. They don't have to go to church. They can find everything on social media, on YouTube or on Spotify. For example, through my music, and so they discover like a new way of being a church.
Another attendee, Barney, who didn't want to give his full name, is a 16-year-old high school student. He says he really got into Christianity just over a year ago, during a time when he was feeling a lot of stress.
I always went out a lot with my friends. I have a lot of different hobbies, and I always enjoy doing it, but then I still miss something. Like, there was still a hole in my heart or something, and I knew, like, how can I fill this up? Because I tried so many different things, but nothing really filled that hole in my heart. And then the moment I went to a church, I just felt my heart being filled, and then I just knew this is it, so I didn't have to look any further.
Social media, he says, inspired him to deepen his faith.
Because when I tried to learn new things about Christianity, like, I could read the Bible, but where else should I look? And then I went to social media, and then I saw a lot of people preaching or talking about faith and how it changed their lives. So that really was a motivation for me to also look further into the religion.
TikTok and Instagram are awash with people building a Christian brand. Some, like Zara Chodemans, are promoting faith in God. And some beauty and skincare products.
I just love a good lip combo. And als er iets is wat ik dus echt letterlijk nooit doe.
The 22-year-old has over 1 million followers on TikTok alone. And considering the population of the Netherlands is only about 18 million, she's captured a large audience.
Dit zijn 7 manieren om het makkelijker te maken om weer terug naar God te gaan. Nummer 1.
In this video, she's offering up 7 ways to get back to God.
Maar even terughalen waar ik dankbaar voor ben.
Dit is tip number 1. Remember what you're grateful for. Even if Christianity isn't your thing, this is always a good one, she says.
I am a Godfluencer. I do influence people about God, about what God is saying.
Chodemans tells me that with Godfluencing comes great responsibility.
So the responsibility that God has given me at this young age, I feel like it's the biggest gift he could give me, next to my daughter, of course.
Chodemans was a bit of a partier as a teenager, but after finding out that she was pregnant with her daughter at age 19, she says that she found her footing in the Pentecostal church. And on TikTok, she found a community of people she could relate to, both as a young mother and as a young Christian.
We all are so searching for identity, searching for a place to be welcomed in, a place to fit in, and also say that you are something that you can find yourself in. And I think the best identity, and actually the only real identity that we can get as a human, is identity in Christ.
She's hoping more people her age will find their place in Christianity. That does seem to be happening. And maybe, she says, God is at work here. For The World in Amsterdam, I'm Joshua Koh.
The street gangs of Central America are notorious for their brutality. People who try to challenge them are often dismissed as naive. Sometimes they pay with their lives. One of the reasons so many try to leave Central America for safety elsewhere. That did not stop two middle-aged dads, one Honduran, one American, from stepping up to confront the gangs in Honduras head-on. Their story is far more complex than good versus evil, though. Journalist Ross Halperin lays it out in his new book, Bear Witness, The Pursuit of Justice in a Violent Land. You spent more than a decade, Ross, following the lives of the two main protagonists of your reporting. Let's start with Carlos Hernandez, a Honduran schoolteacher. Who is he and what's driving him?
Yeah, Carlos grew up in rural Honduras, sort of in banana country near the Caribbean coastline. And as a young man, he really devoted his life to helping the poor. And he decided that the best way to do that would be to live with them. So he makes a decision to move to one of the poorest and most dangerous neighborhoods in all of Honduras. This is a place that most Hondurans would never set foot in. And part of what's driving him is this sense that the evangelical church, which he is part of, is too head in the clouds, too focused on what's going to happen in the afterlife. And he says we as evangelicals need to be more focused on what's happening here on earth in our country, which is poor and violent and corrupt. And that manifests in him moving to this very dangerous neighborhood.
Right. The neighborhood that Carlos moves to is called Nueva Suyapa. Also moving to that neighborhood is Carlos's best buddy, Kurt Verbeek. He's an American sociologist. Tell us about Kurt.
Yeah, so Kurt grew up in suburban Chicago. Then he and his wife, right after college, moved down to Honduras to work for a charitable organization affiliated with their church. And pretty quickly, they decide that they're going to devote their lives to this and that Honduras is not just a great place to help the poor, but also a country that they just love. And so kind of like Carlos, he starts doing the normal stuff that people do to help the poor, but he's doing it inside Nueva Suyapa, which is a place that most gringos would never go and is considered to be very dangerous. But him and his wife decide that they don't want to be hypocrites. And if they're going to help the poor, they should live like the poor themselves. And they move there with their two children and end up loving it. There's a lot of challenges there, like the water only runs through the pipes one day per month. There's a lot of violence, but it's very close-knit and there's trees and there's good things about it too. And it's really there that him and Carlos forge this best friendship. They're next door neighbors. They meet up almost every single day after work to get together and talk.
They're from very different backgrounds, though. I mean, what connects them?
They're from totally different places, but they share extreme courage, extreme optimism, and extreme faith. And that allows them to get together and come up with a very radical and idiosyncratic idea. And that's when they start doing stuff that other humanitarians and missionaries do not do.
Yeah, so talk about what those two men are seeing in Nueva Suyapa. I mean, it's controlled by the Puchos gang. How does this criminal group flex its muscle? And like, what does that bring to this neighborhood?
They come to realize that there's a gang that is killing people, raping people, extorting people, scaring them so much that they're afraid to walk to school or just be outside at night or attend an evening church service. So they say, if we really want to help, we are going to have to get into the business of stopping violence. And what that means at that time is stopping this gang. They say, what we are going to do is try to solve murders. And they hire a private eye and a lawyer, and they start solving murders.
And remind us why the police are not doing this job. They're the ones who are supposed to do it, right?
Exactly. I mean, maybe 10% of violent crimes were even investigated, let alone solved. The reasons why I think were probably pretty predictable. First was extreme poverty. this was a police force that didn't have enough people, didn't have enough cars. You go to their offices, there are desks without computers, there are printers without ink, there are bathrooms without toilet paper. And then it was also a corruption problem. I mean, members of the police force were involved in narco trafficking. Members of the police force were involved in carjacking, doing deals with the gangs themselves. So the people didn't trust the police. And when it came time to testify or witness, and that cop approached you to do that, no one in this neighborhood would participate because they thought the cops were corrupt and the cops were inept as well.
I'm speaking with journalist Ross Halperin, the author of Bear Witness, A Pursuit of Justice in a Violent Land. So Kurt starts a Christian charity called the Association for a More Just Society, ASJ, solving crimes on their own. What was the semi-clandestine group actually designed to do?
One big part of what this secret group does is find witnesses, convince them to testify, and keep them alive. And you don't need a badge to do that. And that's the biggest component of solving a murder. It was basically an intelligence gathering operation that they conducted and then share that information with the police. When dealing with a justice system which was as weak and fragile as this one, the secret group found that they were sort of able to assist and cajole those functionaries to a remarkable degree.
So initially, Carlos and Kurt think they have ethical clarity with their group, the ASJ, but in their fight against the gangs, they find themselves navigating any number of moral gray zones. What do they come up against?
You know, the first big arrest, which they essentially facilitate, which is very successful, it gets about 10 of the gang members arrested. The lawyer working for them sees the cops beat the suspects after they're handcuffed. They see the cops threaten to cripple a detainee with an aluminum baseball bat.
Wow.
Right there, you're confronted with this horrible dilemma because the cops are doing really bad, abusive, inappropriate things. But on the flip side, they did arrest the gang members finally. So right there, you're confronted with this question, do we stop working with the police and shut this program down? Or do we keep going? Another very poignant and painful one is that there's collateral damage. Look, when you start getting witnesses to testify against gang members, I don't think it would surprise anyone that there's repercussions and innocent people get hurt in the story. And once again, Kurt and Carlos are confronted with this choice. Like, we're making progress. These guys are getting arrested. The neighborhood does seem to be getting safer. But someone who we care about was just killed, possibly as a consequence of these machinations.
I mean, the tension is really, you really feel it in this book. And I wonder, after spending so much time sifting through the dilemma faced by many Hondurans living with violent crime, whether you think that Carlos and Kurt's embrace of vigilante-style tactics was inevitable. I mean, is that the nature of the crime-fighting beast in this sort of setting?
Yeah. There's a lot of idealistic people out there in the world who have beautiful ideas and principles, but I think most of them would probably be too scared to actually test them in the real world, because when you do that, especially if you're in a place as challenged and corrupt and violent and poor as Honduras, you're going to have to make compromises and do things you ideally wouldn't want to do in the name of pragmatism and actually getting something done. And I admire these guys that they have been willing to do that. And I do think it is inevitable in a place like Honduras, if you do want to start trying to make a place safer and make change, that you will have to deal with these moral quandaries.
So what happens next?
So they decide they are going to try to reform the police force in its entirety. And they end up getting a lot of political power. And the thing that they want to do from the outset and that people have been trying to do in Honduras for a very long time is purge the police force. So fire the bad cops and replace them with ones that were better. And remarkably, they do pull this off. That happened back in 2016. They fire nearly half of the police force, basically all of the high command. And it's a success, but, you know, once again, not without some moral quandaries. And, you know, since then, I don't think there's been anything like that. In Honduras, there has been talk of bringing in a UN-sponsored anti-corruption commission, sort of like they did in Guatemala. And actually, the current administration really ran on that. But now 3 years into the administration, that still hasn't happened. So I think a lot of Hondurans have lost hope that that's going to come.
What did reporting this book, Ross, show you about why gangs and corrupt authorities in places like Honduras have so much impunity?
Look, I think the degree to which these gangs have scared people and the degree to which the police's behavior through history has led the populace not to trust them has just created the situation where it's really hard to get people to testify. And even though there obviously are good cops and there obviously are so many people who would love nothing more than to step up and testify and help bring down a gang, there's just so much fear and reticence to do that.
Ross Halperin's new nonfiction book about two men who set out to confront criminal gangs in Honduras is called Bear Witness, The Pursuit of Justice in a Violent Land. Ross, it's great to meet you. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Longtime listeners may remember the World's GeoQuiz that tested your knowledge of geography and global trivia. Well, the GeoQuiz is back on our YouTube channel, where you can watch co-host Carolyn Beeler and me sift through the clues and face off to guess a country. Sometimes successfully, sometimes, well...
I've switched it up every single time.
Did you? Wow.
Okay. Yeah. I have no allegiances here. Okay. No faith in myself, I guess.
Okay. Hint number six.
Well, you can't always be perfect. You can find new quizzes along with other features and conversations with our reporters at youtube.com/@theworldnewsgbh. Be sure to subscribe, like, comment, and click on the bell icon to be notified of our next video. You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. For decades, Cuba has been sending doctors all over the world to bring medical care to underserved communities. Cuba calls them missions of solidarity, but the program has long been controversial. Critics say the doctors are forced laborers, and now the U.S. is cracking down by revoking the visas of officials from countries that host these doctors. The Organization of American States is also launching an investigation into the program. The World's TV's Isaiah brings us the voices of Cuban physicians who have been part of the program.
The main motivation for Cuban doctors who join the country's global medical missions isn't adventure or political ideology. It's survival.
Yo ganaba en Cuba el equivalente a $40, que no me alcanzaba para nada.
This gynecologist, who was scared to give her name, says her salary in Cuba was only about $40 a month. You can't do anything with that, she says. With the hope to support her family, she signed a contract in 2018 to go by herself to the African island nation of Seychelles for 3 years.
El contrato te pagaba la casa, el internet, el agua, la electricidad.
The contract offered housing, Wi-Fi, utilities, and a stipend of $700 a month, a fortune compared to her salary in Cuba. But then she learned that the Cuban government would take half her earnings, and that life abroad would be closely monitored.
Entonces, empieza una vigilancia hacia ti. Te sientes acosada por tus propios compañeros.
She told me her own colleagues would watch her, tracking what she was doing in her free time, who she talked to, or what she posted on social media. And when she wanted to marry someone outside the mission with a political ideology not aligned to that of the Cuban government, she got in trouble.
Cuando voy para el hospital, me dicen de que como yo me casé, me tienen que terminar la misión.
Her boss said because she married this guy, they would terminate the contract and she had to go back to Cuba. When she refused, she was labeled as a defector. Abandoning a medical mission is considered a crime, and people are either jailed or can't return to Cuba for 8 years. Another participant, nurse Arisleidy Lopez, found herself living and working in one of Venezuela's most dangerous neighborhoods.
Ellos con pistola, con mini uzi, con no sé cuántas cosas.
Lopez says several times she was threatened by violent criminals pointing their guns at her and saying she had to save their friends. If they died, she would die. Her salary was paid in Venezuelan currency, which suffered hyperinflation to the point it was worth only about $1 a month. The Cuban government deposited about $100 a month in another account that she would lose if she deserted the mission.
Para mí fue el fraude más grande de la vida que hizo el gobierno cubano con nosotros.
It was the biggest fraud of my life, what the Cuban government did to us, she says. One day, she was caught talking to human rights activists, and her supervisor told her she needed to go back to Cuba immediately, where she would be treated as a traitor. López escaped to Colombia and she requested and was granted asylum in the United States last year. She's now in Illinois.
El dolor más grande que tengo ahora mismo y sin poder ver a mi familia.
She says the most painful thing is that she hasn't been able to see her 10-year-old daughter for 4 years. Another Cuban doctor named Elba Rosa also experienced tight control when she served in Venezuela in 2003.
Nos quitaron el pasaporte. No teníamos pasaporte. Teníamos que estar localizados.
She says Cuban officials took her passport the day she arrived, and she didn't see it for 7 years. Any contact with locals was closely monitored as it raised suspicions of desertion. And Rosa says doctors were expected to spread more than medicine.
Pues nosotros tenemos que hacer un censo, pasar por cada casa, hablarle bien en favorable a Chávez, ¿verdad?
We had to do household surveys, she says, and speak well of Venezuela's socialist leader, Hugo Chávez. It was political work, she says. In those surveys, many Venezuelans said they benefited from this program. Some critics acknowledge the service is great for host countries, but the working conditions are so bad that they want the program stopped. Javier Larrondo is the president of Prisoners Defenders, an organization that has interviewed over 1,000 Cuban medical professionals involved in the missions.
We have to eradicate this slavery scheme in all in every single country that they are being executed.
Cuban officials strongly reject the accusations that these missions amount to forced labor.
Siempre se ha hecho y se inició sobre una base de solidaridad entre una cantidad de dinero del Estado cubano. ¿Y en qué se invierte ese dinero?
In an April interview, Cuban President Miguel Díaz-Canel said the program is altruistic and that the money the government gets is reinvested in the country's medical system. What's been done is a political campaign to discredit it, he said. Earlier this year, Cuba's Ministry of Health, José Portal Miranda, acknowledged that the missions have confiscated participants' passports in the past, but that it is not happening anymore. Not all Cuban doctors see the missions as abusive or coercive.
Me ha permitido hacer muchas cosas que en
a doctor who's
no
currently working
hacer.
In Mexico and would only speak anonymously says the program has given her professional purpose and allowed her to see the world. She says she has never felt threatened or controlled and that, in her words, if you behave correctly, nothing happens.
Pero yo me siento satisfecha con lo que tengo porque
she says she feels content and doesn't mind that the government keeps a portion of her salary because it's her way to give back after studying medicine for free. This doctor says she doesn't know how much money the Cuban government is taking, but Javier Larrondo says in most cases it's a lot.
Professionals every year working abroad to profit the Cuban government with 85 to 95% of their salaries.
Larrondo says it's difficult to know exactly how much the medical program generates for Cuba, but it's definitely one of the country's main sources of income. So each doctor who defects means a financial loss. Cuban officials say there are about 24,000 people posted in 54 countries. That's fewer than what it used to be when the program peaked in 2014 because of political and financial disputes with several countries. Most recently, the Bahamas decided to cancel contracts with Cuban doctors under pressure from the Trump administration. For the world, I'm Tibisa Isea, Mexico City.
Thank you for making it here today. The World is produced by GBH and PRX. Broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio in Boston and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you right back here tomorrow.
The World is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. From the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include Sherry Mallon and Jonathan Abbott, Paula and Cy DeCoss, William Reynolds, Carolyn Talcott, and the Patchwork Collective. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.
From PRX.